Hello, and welcome to the reading of the Sioux City Journal for Wednesday, April 24th, 2024. I'm your reader, Grace Barter. A Sioux City woman has pleaded guilty of inadequately caring for her five-year-old child. Ashley LaFave, 33, entered her plea Wednesday in Woodbury Court County District Court to one count of child endangerment, an aggravated misdemeanor that was reduced from felony neglect of a dependent person as part of a plea agreement. She admitted she inadequately supervised, fed, and clothed her son and inadequately cleaned their home. According to terms of the plea agreement, LaFave will be sentenced to probation and a second count of neglect of a dependent person will be dismissed. Sentencing is scheduled for June 3rd. LaFave's five-year-old son walked to Bryant Elementary School on March 27, 2023 to retrieve a toy from his older brother. Unable to contact LaFave, school staff gave the boy food because he said he was hungry. The boy showed up that evening at the 1000 block of Hill Avenue, where he told the resident he was cold and hungry and was looking for his brother. Officers took the boy to his apartment in the 2700 block of Virginia Street and observed food and possibly rodent droppings on the living room floor. The kitchen smelled of rotten food, the sink was full of dirty dishes, and the refrigerator had mostly alcohol inside it. The toilet was clogged and the children's beds had no bedding. 2 days later, an officer spoke with LaFave, who said she worked various overnight or morning hours at a fast food restaurant and didn't know her son had left the apartment and walked to school. Local law enforcement officers, whose investigation of a string of armed robberies in Siouxland led to the arrest and conviction of the perpetrator, have been honored by the U.S. Attorney's Office. Sioux City Police Detectives Michael Sitzman and Nate West, Sioux City Police Investigator Joaquin Orduno, and FBI Special Agent Bradley Colligan are recipients of the Law Enforcement Victim Services Award from the U.S. Attorney's Office for the Northern District of Iowa. The award was announced in conjunction with National Crime Victims' Rights Week this week. The five were instrumental in the arrest and prosecution of Kevon Spratt, who was suspected of at least five armed robberies in the tri-state area in 2022. A federal court jury ultimately found him guilty of committing armed robberies in Sergeant Bluff, Sioux City, and Salix, Iowa, and he was sentenced to 36 years in federal prison. Spratt also was suspected of robberies in Nebraska and South Dakota. We are fortunate in the Northern District of Iowa to have excellent resources for victims of domestic and sexual violence, as well as resources for survivors of homicide and other violent crimes, U.S. Attorney Tim Duax said in a news release. Our personnel are our greatest asset. They are trained to provide compassionate, consistent, and comprehensive services to crime victims across the state of Iowa. A common theme of the Tuesday morning ribbon-cutting ceremony for the new meter building in Sheldon was perseverance. More than one speaker at the event noted how long it had taken for the Northwest Iowa town to get hooked up to the long-planned Lewis and Clark Regional Water System, which was incorporated in 1990. Today, we are here to celebrate this monumental event. This pipe dream is now a pipe reality, Sheldon Mayor Greg Giles said. Not all who have played a role in this are here today. Some have passed away, others have moved away or had other obligations. Sheldon joined up with the Tri-State 20-member nonprofit wholesale provider of treated drinking water in 1993. It took 7 years for the Congress to authorize the plan. The system began delivering water in 2012, and the towns of Hull, Sheldon, and Sioux Center all started receiving water in 2023. The hookup for Sheldon didn't finally materialize until December, which is what pushed the ribbon cutting into the springtime. In total, the system represents a 5,000 square mile service area for an estimated 350,000 people. Sheldon reserved 1.3 million. In total, the system represents a 5,000 square mile service area for an estimated 350,000 people. Sheldon reserved 1.3 million gallons a day and will have access to another 756,000 GPD once an expansion is completed in 2030. The Sheldon project, which includes the new meter building, a water tower, and PVC pipe running to other towns, and works used funding from the bipartisan infrastructure law, which was passed by Congress and signed by President Joe Biden in November of 2021. GOP Senator Chuck Grassley is the only current member of the Iowa congressional delegation to vote for the legislation, while Republican Senator Joni Ernst and Republican Representatives Randy Feenstra and Marionette Miller Meeks voted against the measure. Representatives Ashley Hinson and Zach Nunn were not in office at the time. The Troy Larson, an executive director for the Lewis and Clark Regional Water System, said construction was able to be sped up by a decade because of funding from the BIL. Feenstra, who served on the board for the Lewis and Clark Regional Water System before his time as a congressman, talked about how much he pushed for the project as a Hull city administrator, state legislator, and congressman, and emphasized how important it was to keep the dream alive. Rocco Sanchez, a senior advisor for the federal government's Bureau of Reclamation, which oversees water resource management, touted the completion of the Sheldon project as a demonstration of the impact Biden's infrastructure bill and Inflation Reduction Act were having on local communities, and said the administration was working to make such places more resilient to the impacts of drought and climate change. The importance of such an undertaking when Iowa is still being plagued by drought is something Colby DeWitt, an outreach director for Ernst, noted as well. O'Brien and Sioux counties are not presently in a drought, but 64 counties have USDA disaster designations, according to data from the National Integrated Drought Information System. The remaining cities to be connected are Sibley, Iowa, and Madison, South Dakota. Madison is expected to be connected in summer 2024, and Sibley in late 2024, early 2025. Work has already begun on a $125 million expansion to increase the system's capacity to 60 million GPD. Thus far, more than $584 million in federal, state, and local funds has been spent or committed to the Lewis and Clark Regional Water System, and it has received or been greenlit for more than $142 million of funding through the BIL. Sioux City Elementary Schools will start at 8:30 a.m. next year, a 5-minute earlier start. The Sioux City School Board approved the first reading of the policy change Monday during their regular meeting. No public or board comment was made about the change to school hours. Currently, elementary schools start at 8:35 a.m., middle schools at 7:45 a.m., and high schools at 7:55 a.m. Middle school and high school start times will remain. Associate Superintendent Angela Bemis said currently the bell rings at 8:35 a.m., and then the tardy bell rings at 8:40 a.m. She said, because of this, the elementary school students were receiving 5 fewer minutes of instruction compared to the middle schools and high schools. Iowa law requires there be the same amount of instruction at the elementary school, middle school, and high school. Parents are used to having a tardy bell, and so are our teachers and students. So we just backed up the time instead of getting rid of the tardy bell, Bemis said. The board also approved a policy change moving the weekly early outs to Fridays instead of Mondays. Instead of a 1 hour early out on Mondays, the district is moving to 2 hour early outs on Fridays for professional development and teacher work time. Human Resources Director Jen Gomez said previously the change is based on feedback received from district staff, parents, and committees. Both changes were made during the annual review of school calendars. Each year, the district reviews the school calendar and the changes to go before the board for approval. Both policy changes will go before the board again on May 13th for final approval. Construction has begun on Nebraska Highway 9 north of Pender. Work includes repair of 3 bridges, each of which will be reduced to 1-lane traffic controlled by traffic signals while bridge work is completed. Construction is anticipated to take approximately 3 months, according to the Nebraska Department of Transportation. In the National News Digest, U.S. companies would no longer be able to bar employees from taking jobs with competitors under a rule approved by a federal agency. The Federal Trade Commission voted 3-2 on Tuesday to ban measures known as non-compete agreements, which bar workers from jumping to or starting competing companies for a prescribed period of time. According to the FTC, 30 million people, roughly 1 in 5 workers, are subject to such restrictions. The rule, which doesn't apply to workers at nonprofits, is to take effect in 4 months unless it is blocked by legal challenges. The Biden administration took aim at non-compete measures, which are associated with executives at technology and financial companies, but also ensnare lower-paid workers. A 2021 study by the Federal Reserve Bank of Minneapolis found more than 1 in 10 workers who earn $20 or less an hour are covered by non-compete agreements. The Biden administration finalized a new rule set to make millions of more salaried workers eligible for overtime pay in the U.S. It's the largest expansion in federal overtime eligibility in decades. Starting July 1st, employers will be required to pay overtime to salaried workers who make less than $43,888 a year in certain executive, administrative, and professional roles, the Labor Department said Tuesday. That cap will rise to $58,656 by the start of 2025. The current overtime eligibility threshold of $35,568 was set under the Trump administration in 2019, 3 years after a more generous Obama-era effort ultimately was scuttled in court after pushback from some business leaders and Republican politicians. David Joseph Geitzen, 31, of Sanford, North Carolina, who became a fugitive after a federal jury convicted him of assaulting police officers during the January 6, 2021 U.S. Capitol riot, was sentenced Tuesday to 6 years in prison. The U.S. Supreme Court on Tuesday appeared likely to side with Starbucks in a case that could make it harder for the federal government to seek injunctions when it suspects a company of interfering in unionization campaigns. Former Republican U.S. Representative George Santos of New York said Tuesday He will drop his long-shot bid to return to Congress after his campaign committee reported no fundraising or expenditures in March. He was expelled from the House months ago while facing federal fraud charges. The United Nations called Tuesday for a clear, transparent, and credible investigation of mass graves uncovered at two major hospitals in war-torn Gaza that were raided by Israeli troops. Wall Street Journal reporter Evan Gershkovich will remain jailed on espionage charges until at least late June, after a Moscow court rejected his appeal Tuesday that sought to end his pretrial detention. The U.S. Food and Drug Administration said Tuesday that samples of pasteurized milk tested positive for remnants of the bird flu virus that infected dairy cows, but stressed the material is inactivated and doesn't pose a risk. Officials said they continue to study the issue. The U.S. Justice Department announced a $138.7 million settlement Tuesday with more than 100 people who accused the FBI of grossly mishandling allegations of sexual assault against Larry Nassar in 2015 and 2016, a critical time gap that allowed the sports doctor to continue to prey on victims before his arrest. When combined with other settlements, $1 billion now has been set aside by various organizations to compensate hundreds of women who said Nassar assaulted them under the guise of treatment for sports injuries. Nassar worked at Michigan State University and also served as a team doctor at Indianapolis-based USA Gymnastics. He's now serving decades in prison for assaulting female athletes. Acting Associate Attorney General Benjamin Meiser said Nassar betrayed the trust of those in his care for decades and that the allegations should have been taken seriously from the outset. For more than a year, FBI agents in Indianapolis and Los Angeles had knowledge of allegations against him, but apparently took no action, an internal investigation found. The Senate passed $95 billion in war aid to Ukraine, Israel, and Taiwan, sending the legislation to President Joe Biden after months of delays and continuous debate over how involved the United States should be in foreign wars. The Senate passed the bill on an overwhelming 79-18 vote late Tuesday after the House approved the package Saturday. Biden, who worked with congressional leaders to win support, is expected to quickly sign the legislation and start the process of sending weapons to Ukraine, which has been struggling to hold its front lines against Russia. The legislation also would send $26 billion in wartime assistance to Israel and humanitarian relief to Gaza, and $8 billion to counter Chinese threats in Taiwan and the Indo-Pacific. The $61 billion for Ukraine comes as the war-torn country desperately needs new firepower. U.S. officials said the Pentagon was preparing about $1 billion of the aid to be on its way shortly. The legislation also would force TikTok's China-based parent company to sell the social media platform under the threat of a ban, a contentious move that's expected to face legal challenges. A veteran tabloid publisher testified Tuesday that he pledged to be Donald Trump's eyes and ears during his 2016 presidential campaign, recounting how he promised the then candidate he would help suppress harmful stories and even arranged to purchase a doorman's silence. The testimony from David Pecker was designed to bolster prosecutors' assertions of a decades-long friendship between Trump and the former publisher of the National Enquirer that it culminated in an agreement to give up the candidate's lawyer a heads up on negative tips and stories so they could be squashed. Pecker is the first witness in Trump's history-making hush money trial in Manhattan, where he faces 34 felony counts of falsifying business records in connection with payments meant to be prevent harmful stories from surfacing during the 2016 campaign. Testimony resumes Thursday. The effort to suppress unflattering information was designed to illegally influence the election, prosecutors allege in seeking to elevate the gravity of the first trial of a former American president and the first of four criminal cases against Trump to reach a jury. Pecker detailed his involvement in Trump's rise from political novice to the Republican nomination and then the White House. He explained how he and the National Enquirer parlayed rumor-mongering into splashy tabloid stories that smeared Trump's opponents and, just as crucially, leveraged his connections to suppress seamy stories about Trump, including a porn actor's claim of an extramarital sexual encounter a decade earlier. Pecker traced the origins of their relationship to a 1980s Trump meeting at Trump's Mar-a-Lago estate in Palm Beach, Florida. Their ties were solidified during a pivotal August 2015 meeting at Trump Tower involving Trump, his lawyer, and a personal fixer, Michael Cohen, and another aide, Hope Hicks, in which Pecker was asked what he could do for the campaign. Pecker said he volunteered to publish positive stories about Trump and negative stories about his opponents. He said he also told Trump, "I will be your eyes and ears." I said that anything I hear in the marketplace, if I hear anything negative about yourself or if I hear about women selling stories, I would notify Michael Cohen so that the rights could be purchased and the stories could be killed. Pecker painted Cohen as a shadow editor of the National Enquirer's pro-Trump coverage, directing the tabloid to go after whichever Republican candidates were gaining in momentum. What began last week when Columbia University students refused to end their protest against Israel's war with Hamas turned into a much larger movement by Tuesday as students across the U.S. set up encampments, occupied buildings, and ignored demands to leave. Protests bubbled for months, but kicked into a higher gear after more than 100 pro-Palestinian demonstrators who camped out on Columbia's Upper Manhattan campus were arrested Thursday. Dozens more protesters were arrested at other campuses since, and many now face charges of trespassing or disorderly conduct. With tensions at Columbia continuing to run high, and some students afraid to set foot on the campus, officials said the Ivy League school will switch to hybrid learning for the rest of the semester, which will be finished by the end of next week. At New York University, police said 133 protesters were taken into custody late Monday, and all were released with summonses to appear in court on disorderly conduct charges. New York City Mayor Eric Adams said police officers were hit with bottles and other objects at some protests. In Connecticut, police arrested 60 protesters, including 47 students, Monday at Yale University after they refused to leave an encampment in a campus plaza. In the Midwest on Tuesday, a demonstration at the center of the University of Michigan campus grew to nearly 40 tents, and police arrested 9 anti-war protesters at the University of Minnesota after taking down an encampment in front of the library. Hundreds later rallied to the Minnesota campus to demand their release. On the West Coast, California State Polytechnic University, Humboldt, announced its campus would be closed through Wednesday after demonstrators occupied a building Monday night. 3 protesters were arrested. Classes were to be conducted remotely, the school said on its website. Campus protests began after the Hamas-led October 7th attack on Israel, which left about 1,200 people dead. Militants took about 250 hostages. During the ensuing war, Israel has killed more than 34,000 Palestinians in Gaza, according to the health ministry there. The New York Civil Liberties Union on Tuesday cautioned universities against being too quick to call in law enforcement. And back at home, for many people, there's a never-ending supply of plastic bags in their homes. Now, there is a way to put those plastic bags to use while helping the unsheltered in the community. Looming Matters, based in the Grace United Methodist Church, has started making sleeping mats out of donated shopping bags in Sioux City. Each mat utilizes between 700 and 800 plastic shopping bags, keeping them out of landfills and providing a comfortable dry mat for the unsheltered to utilize. "People are happy to give you their plastic bags," said Kathy Martin, a retired pastor. During a mission trip to Jefferson, Iowa, Grace Methodist members learned about the project from Midwest Mission. The mats can be used for the unhoused in the community as well as be shipped throughout the country, especially to places that are experiencing natural disasters. Grace United does not distribute the mats. Currently, they are working to partner with organizations throughout the community that will be able to distribute them. The Food Bank of Siouxland is one of those organizations, Martin said. The process of making the mats is fairly simple. Each loom is handmade for this specific purpose. The top and bottom of the bags are cut off, and the remaining strips are woven, similar to the way woven potholders are made. The mats are tightly woven because many people will use them on the ground. "We want to keep moisture away from their bodies," she said. Not all bags are made equal, varying in size and thickness. Martin said the more mats people work on, the more preferences they develop. High-quality bags, such as Menards, are in high demand, as well as colored bags. Despite the differences, Martin said any plastic bags will work. "We'll use them all, even the ones that are kind of thin," she said. No part of the bags goes to waste. Martin said the parts of the bags that are cut off go to a company, Trex, that turns the plastic into park benches. Since starting the project in October, Looming Matters has made 15 mats. The goal is to provide the mats to organizations in the community that can provide them to people who need them. So far, they have given a few mats to the food pantry and hope to expand. One of the mat makers said they believe in sharing the love of God with people throughout the world and hope that those who receive the mats know that they were made by someone who cares for them. During worship, the congregation prays over the mats. The group makes mats at 10:30 a.m. on Mondays, 1 p.m. on Tuesdays, and at 9 a.m. on Sundays. Martin said anyone is welcome to join in. She said it is a great time to socialize, and the process is simple enough to hold conversations while looming. "It's a very fun way to get together, to talk, and yet to do some good for some people," Martin said. Questions about making the mats and where to donate plastic bags can be directed to Martin at gmakmart@gmail.com. You are listening to the reading of the Sioux City Journal for Wednesday, April 24th, 2024, on IRIS, a Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. Now, today there are no obituaries, so we will move on to some sports news. Caitlin Clark appears to be on the cusp of setting another record. The most prolific scorer in NCAA Division I history and the number one overall pick in the WNBA draft, will continue her association with Nike by signing a $28 million contract that spans 8 years and includes a signature shoe. The Wall Street Journal and The Athletic reported the pending deal, citing unnamed people familiar with the negotiations. Excel Sports Management, which represents Clark, declined to comment. Nike did not immediately respond to a request for comment from the Associated Press. Clark's initial name, image, and likeness deal, signed in 2022, expired at the end of the 23-24 season. The new deal would be the richest sponsorship contract for a women's basketball player. Under Armour and Adidas also participated in contract discussion with Clark's team in February, according to the WSJ and Athletic. Clark received offers of $16 million over 4 years from Under Armour and $6 million over 4 years from Adidas, with both including a signature shoe, according to the WSJ. Clark earned about $3 million in NIL money at Iowa with deals she has made with State Farm, Gatorade, and others, according to On3.com. Clark's agents were working on the new Nike contract even before she announced she would turn pro instead of return to Iowa for a fifth season. After averaging 31.6 points and leading the Hawkeyes to a second straight national championship game, Clark was drafted number one by the Indiana Fever on April 15th. She'll earn a $76,000 salary as a rookie. In some NFL briefs from the Chicago Bears, general manager Ryan Poles wasn't quite ready to announce that Chicago will take Caleb Williams with the number one pick in the NFL draft on Tuesday. He said everyone will have to tune in on Thursday to watch. Barring a massive surprise, the Bears will kick off the draft by grabbing the 2022 Heisman Trophy winner and setting themselves on a course they hope takes them to the top of the NFL. From the Rams, quarterback Stetson Bennett has rejoined Los Angeles for the start of its off-season program after missing his entire rookie season for undisclosed reasons. Bennett is attending team meetings and lifting weights with his teammates at the Rams training complex, Coach Sean McVay confirmed. From the Eagles, the NFL has reinstated Philadelphia cornerback Isaiah Rodgers after a year-long suspension for violating the league's gambling policy. The league said Tuesday that Rodgers has been cleared to participate in team activities, effective immediately. In news from the NBA, the top two seeds in each conference had very different outings in their playoff openers. In the East, the Boston Celtics mostly rolled through a Miami Heat team missing Jimmy Butler. In the West, the Oklahoma City Thunder needed a big game from MVP finalist Shai Gilgeous-Alexander to fend off the New Orleans Pelicans for their first home playoff victory since 2019. Both top seeds expect to see adjustments from their opponents in Game 2. Miami will seek to address the three-point shooting disparity Boston had in Game 1. Oklahoma City will be looking to generate more offense from a roster that had 7 players participating in their first playoff game. Tyrese Maxey was 6th in the most improved player voting 2 years ago, a tribute to the jump he made between his first and second seasons in the NBA. Voters thought the jump he made from his third year to his fourth was more impressive. Philadelphia's All-Star guard was named the league's most improved this season on Tuesday night. Maxey finished the regular season averaging 25.9 points, 6.2 assists, 3.7 rebounds, and 1 steal per game, all career bests. Minnesota's ownership dispute is moving into mediation. The first session toward determining whether Glenn Taylor will remain controlling owner or cede to Mark Lohr and Alex Rodriguez has been scheduled for May 1st, according to an AP source. And some things that happened today in history. On April 24th, 1995, the final bomb linked to the Unabomber exploded inside the Sacramento, California offices of a lobbying group for the wood products industry, killing chief lobbyist Gilbert B. Murray. Theodore Kaczynski was later sentenced to 4 lifetimes in prison for a series of bombings that killed 3 people and injured 29 others. On this date, in 1877, federal troops were ordered out of New Orleans, ending the North's post-Civil War rule in the South. In 1915, in what's considered the start of the Armenian Genocide, the Ottoman Empire began rounding up Armenian political and cultural leaders in Constantinople. In 1960, rioting erupted in Biloxi, Mississippi, after black protesters staging a wade-in at a whites-only beach were attacked by a crowd of hostile white people. In 1961, in the wake of the failed Bay of Pigs invasion of Cuba, the White House issued a statement saying that President John F. Kennedy bears sole responsibility for the events of the past few days. In 1962, the Massachusetts Institute of Technology achieved the first satellite relay of a television signal between Camp Parks, California, and Westford, Massachusetts. In 1967, Soviet cosmonaut Vladimir Komarov was killed when his Soyuz 1 spacecraft crashed after his parachutes failed to deploy properly during re-entry. He was the first human spaceflight fatality. In 1980, the United States launched an unsuccessful attempt to free the American hostages in Iran, a mission that resulted in the deaths of 8 U.S. servicemen. In 1990, the Space Shuttle Discovery blasted off from Cape Canaveral, Florida, carrying the $1.5 billion Hubble Space Telescope. In 2005, Pope Benedict XVI formally began his stewardship of the Roman Catholic Church. The former Cardinal Joseph Ratzinger said in his installation homily that as pontiff he would listen to the will of God in governing the world's 1.1 billion Catholics. In 2013, in Bangladesh, a shoddily constructed 8-story commercial building housing garment factories collapsed, killing more than 1,100 people. In 2018, former police officer Joseph DeAngelo was arrested at his home near Sacramento, California, after DNA linked him to crimes attributed to the Golden State Killer. Authorities believed he committed 13 murders and more than 50 rapes in the 1970s and 80s. DeAngelo pleaded guilty in 2020 to 13 counts of murder and was sentenced to life in prison without parole. From the humor column, Jerry Ziesma says, "I haven't taken a bath since the Johnson administration. Lyndon, not Andrew. And it looks like the drought will continue because boys aren't allowed in our newly renovated bathroom." That is the edict handed down by our 3 granddaughters, ages 11, 7, and 4. Even before the renovation began, they taped a sign to the door reading, "Girls only, no boys allowed." Yes, I know the word girls should be plural, not possessive, But you must understand that these girls are A, young, and B, very possessive of the bathroom they use when they visit our house. They have an ally in their grandmother, my wife, Sue, a girl who doubled down on the order when she told me the only boy on the premises that the bathroom was hers. Sue doesn't mind sharing it with our granddaughters, who love to splash in the tub, but the rest of the time she wants the place to herself. I don't blame her. For the first 11 years of our marriage, we lived in an apartment with only one bathroom. Sue and our two then young daughters, now the mothers of our granddaughters, complained that I took too much time doing important manly things like trimming my nose hairs and cutting myself to ribbons while shaving. When we moved into a condo, the situation was somewhat better, but we were still in each other's way when it came to personal hygiene and answering the call of nature. For the first quarter of a century, Sue and I have lived in a house with 2.5 bathrooms. We have shared the main bathroom, which has a shower but no bathtub. The other full bathroom, which is larger than ours, has a shower and tub and was recently renovated. It was seldom used except when our granddaughters came over to put on makeup, frost cupcakes, play outside, and wash everything off in the bath. This got me thinking. It would be nice, after all these years, to take a bath, too. I typically take showers that use enough water to drown a walrus, but now that we have a brand new tub, I have been tempted to pamper myself by soaking in a warm, relaxing bubble bath. I remember the old TV commercial for Calgon Bath and Beauty Products. A woman was in the tub, strategically covered by bubbles, smiling contentedly and exclaiming, "Calgon, take me away." I can envision myself in a new commercial up to my neck in soothing water and strategically covered by bubbles, which would be appropriate since I am a bubblehead. I would also be playing with my granddaughter's bath toys, which include a couple of rubber duckies. "Quack, quack," I would exclaim, to which I would add, "Calgon, take me away." If that ever happened, Sue would call the authorities to have me taken away. Then she would have both full bathrooms to herself. But after so many years, it's natural for spouses to want their own space. Even the most loving couples, as we are, need a little privacy. That is why I am staking a claim to the main bathroom, which was renovated last year. I won't go so far as to tape a sign to the door reading, "Boys only, no girls allowed," but I do think I deserve a sanctuary where I can trim my nose hairs, take marathon showers, and bleed profusely while shaving. The problem is that Sue hasn't fully moved into her own bathroom yet, so we are still sharing the main bathroom. That's all right with me because I am not a selfish guy. So I don't mind it when I am brushing my teeth and Sue wants to do the same. I simply smile, which causes toothpaste to drip out of my mouth, and move over. But I am sometimes tempted, when nobody is around, to stand in the shower and exclaim, "Calgon, take me away." In Barbara Intermel's nutrition column, a college student in Illinois writes, "I've always been interested in nutrition, and one of the things I see popping up all the time is something called the blood type diet. I know that losing weight has nothing to do with your blood type, but there's another part of this diet regarding lectins that I've always wondered about. The author of this book claims if we eat foods that are wrong for our blood type, these lectins cause clumping of red blood cells. This supposedly leads to disease and illness later in life. Numerous foods are claimed to be healthy for people with certain blood types and bad for other blood types. Some of my favorite foods are supposedly bad for me because I am blood type A. I love tomatoes, cashews, avocados, mangoes, coconut, and yogurt, but according to the blood type diet, they are all bad for me and cause agglutination, which leads to possible disease and illness. Maybe you can debunk this or point me in the right direction to somebody who can explain this. And Barbara Intermill answers, I appreciate your confusion. This diet was popularized back in 1996 with a book called Eat Right for Your Type by neuropathic physician Dr. Peter D'Adamia. D'Adamia states, if you eat lectins that you are not compatible with your blood type, you can experience serious health effects. Trouble is, there have been no valid studies to prove his hypothesis. One study in 2013 searched all the available evidence and found no particular benefit. Another study in 2014 reported that any health effects seen with these diets was not related to blood type. Lectins are real, however, and some can be toxic, such as those found in raw legumes, such as beans, lentils, peas, soybeans, and peanuts. But who wants to eat raw beans anyway? Boiling them in water deactivates these proteins. Here's another twist. Some lectins are actually being studied for their ability to kill off dangerous viruses and fight disease. My advice to you, unless you have another reason to avoid the foods you love, I wouldn't base my choices on blood type. John M. in Lynchburg, Virginia, asks, a recent column mentioned the benefit of many foods, including nuts. My question concerns peanuts. I understand peanuts are not from a tree, but grow underground. We normally have them in our house. Do these provide any of the benefits of tree nuts, or were they called peanuts to eliminate the rather backward sound of goober peas? The answer? You're right, John. Despite their name, peanuts are legumes, not nuts. They are higher in protein than tree nuts and do provide similar health benefits. And according to the Peanut Institute, 98 to 100% of lectins are destroyed by boiling or roasting. I'll save goober peas for another column. In today's weather, today's partly sunny, high of 67 with a wind southeast 6 to 12 mph. Tonight, clearing with a wind southeast 7 to 14 and a low of 52. The national forecast, a storm moving off the northeast coast today will bring rain and wet snow to New England. Spotty thunderstorms will spread farther south through the mid-Atlantic. A developing storm will trigger showers and thunderstorms in the central and southern plains. Thunderstorms can occur from northern California to southern Wyoming. If you want to watch TV for some entertainment, The Conners on ABC at 7 p.m. In the new episode, Manifesting Marriage Testing and Cheeseballs, The Conners relish National Cheeseball Day as a family. Meanwhile, Harris, played by Emma Kenney, falls behind on her work duties at the lunchbox, while Darlene, played by Sarah Gilbert, and Ben, played by Jay Ferguson, must figure out how to spend time together despite their two separate schedules. On PBS, at 7 p.m., Changing Planet, the Coral Special. This program covers the third year of a seven-year project to examine the issues facing our planet's most threatened ecosystems. Dr. M. Sanjayan visits the Maldives to take in an in-depth look at coral reefs and the urgent efforts to keep them and reefs worldwide survive climate change that is warming the seas and causing corals to bleach and possibly die off in the next few decades. And at 8 p.m., A Brief History of the Future, in the new episode Human, host Ari Wallach investigates the human ability to increase empathy and compassion, what values we are instilling into artificial intelligent technologies, and creating a better world for human life to flourish on this planet. On CBS at 8:30, The Amazing Race. Teams must put on their best performance in Montevideo, Uruguay, when they choose between banging out a drum routine with street performers or singing a Spanish tune with professional troubadours in the new episode Walk and Chew Gum, Baby. On Fox at 7 p.m., The Masked Singer. In the new episode, Girl Group Night, the Masked Singer panelists open the show with a performance of the Spice Girls' Wannabe. Then, Carney Wilson and Raven Simone make guest appearances before the Season 11 contestants rock out to girl group classics like Free Your Mind and I'm So Excited. At 8 p.m., in the new episode, Skunks and Swans, Frank and Shred, Joel McHale and Michael Rowland, head to a country club to take on an aggressive swan that has antagonized Frank before. On National Geographic at 8 p.m., a season's premiere of To Catch a Smuggler. The docuseries returns to follow the men and women of the Department of Homeland Security, whose agencies make up a three-tiered defense of America's airports. Using every tool available to them, the department will stop at nothing to catch a smuggler. In the season premiere, Cocaine Leaks and Ancient Greeks, a Homeland Security investigation chases fleeing coke smugglers near a school. Plus, Customs and Border Protection finds shipments of pills, ketamine, and counterfeit cash, and stops knockoff shoes at the border. If you're looking for some hometown entertainment, the I Mom So Hard comedy duo Kristen Hensley and Jen Smedley are bringing their brand new I Mom So Hard Live Ladies Night to the Orpheum Theater at 528 Pierce Street. The ladies dive into all things womanhood, motherhood, and friendship for a show that is rowdy, raucous, and even a bit naughty. Tickets will go on sale at 10 a.m. Friday at OrpheumLive.com or at the Prime Bank box office. And that does it for today's reading of the Sioux City Journal for Wednesday, April 24th, 2024. I'm your reader, Grace Barter. You can access a recording of today's reading on our website, iowaradioreading.org, anytime. Thanks for listening. Thank you.
In Africa, 5-year-old Charu has no choice. She and millions like her must walk miles every day for dirty water. But together, we can end their walk by providing clean water close by. Instead of spending hours walking to get water that makes them sick, girls can be in a classroom that expands their minds, and moms will gain back time to care for their families. Sons and daughters can grow up strong, finally free of sicknesses caused by dirty water. At World Vision, care about clean water runs deep. Deep enough to reach one new person with clean water every 10 seconds. Because every child, every person, everywhere deserves clean water and the chance to rise to their full potential. It's true. When you just add water, you change a life. Learn more at worldvision.org.
From the Bureau of Economic Geology, this is Earth Date. A decade ago, there were typically 20 earthquakes a year that were large enough to feel in the central and eastern U.S. But in 2015, there were over 1,000 of them. Why? It's mostly because we're pumping more water into the ground. The boom in U.S. oil and gas production over the last decade has brought many more oil wells, which also produce water. Most is naturally occurring in the formation, and some was injected by operators to allow or improve the recovery of oil and gas. In both cases, the water will likely have picked up salt and other minerals from the rock, making it many times saltier than seawater. Operators may re-inject this water to continue to liberate oil and gas. But more often, there's too much to handle, so it's trucked or piped to disposal wells, where it's pumped down into deep saltwater reservoirs. Adding large volumes of wastewater increases the pressure in these rock formations, which can allow natural faults to slip more easily than they normally would, causing earthquakes. To address these quakes, regulators and the petroleum industry are monitoring disposal wells and shutting down those that could cause damaging seismic activity. And they now think that managing wastewater injection more carefully should help. There's still more work to be done, and university research centers, like the Bureau of Economic Geology, are conducting major studies with the aim of minimizing the risk of earthquakes while maintaining the benefits of domestic energy production. For Earth Date, I'm Scott Tinker.
Earth Date is produced by the Bureau of Economic Geology at the University of Texas at Austin, with support from Schlumberger, helping oil and gas companies increase production and efficiency while lowering environmental impact. You can hear more Earth Date stories at earthdate.org.